From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
We start this hour with a closer look at the president's new coronavirus testing strategy.
Right now, just 5.4 million tests have been conducted in the U.S. Yesterday at a presidential press conference, the president pledged 2 million a week.
Our blueprint describes how states should unlock their full capacity, expand the number of testing platforms, establish monitoring systems to detect local outbreaks, and conduct contact tracing. We have it all.
But there are voices of caution about that 2 million a week benchmark. Even Dr. Brett Giroir, who oversees the White House testing efforts, said it will be less. And the responsibility to ramp up tests rests on private companies, including CVS, partnering with the government. Lev Fasher is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Lev, these private partnerships aren't new. CVS has been doing testing in several states, including Rhode Island and Michigan. But most CVS stores have signs saying they don't offer the COVID-19 test. So what are they planning?
So CVS in particular is saying that they're hoping that by the end of May, they're going to have 1,000 locations across the country online offering tests for the coronavirus in their parking lots, at drive-through locations that are going to allow their employees to test folks safely and wearing protective equipment and not in the confines of their physical stores. And their goal is to perform about 1.5 million each month, which is about 20% of the total number that a lot of public health officials estimate the country needs to safely reopen. So from CVS alone, it's a really significant commitment, and it represents a substantial chunk of what is needed as state governments start the process of reopening their economies.
Well, but Vice President Pence said there would be 2 million tests per week by the end of May. You're talking about CVS doing this piece of it, which might be a million or so a month. What are, first of all, some of the roadblocks? We heard about all sorts of shortages of swabs, of the reagents that are needed to do the testing. What's happened there?
There have certainly been supply chain issues in terms of the reagents, in terms of just the physical testing kits. There's also a pretty substantial backlog just in terms of the workforce required to conduct these tests. And there have been some disconnects also between the federal government and state governments and commercial labs. And in recent weeks, the Trump administration has really, really pushed state governments to lean more on the commercial lab capacity in their states. But it's worth noting that the Trump administration proposal, they issued this blueprint on Monday evening that's pretty light on detail, but Vice President Mike Pence said that by the end of May, they hope that the U.S. can conduct 2 million tests per week, which is not so ambitious, given that in the past week, there were about 1.6 million tests conducted. So it's pretty close already. But there are a lot of estimates from leading public health officials that show the actual demand for tests as being dramatically higher, between 3 and 4 million per week, to safely reopen the economy, to allow Americans to return to work, eventually to allow folks to return to school. So it does rely on a lot of cooperation between private companies, private pharmacies, state governments, the federal government. And even if all goes well, there are public health officials who say it won't be enough regardless.
Well, STAT did the analysis, and we can link you to it, with these leading public health officials of what kind of testing might be needed. And as you say, researchers are estimating that it's between 3 and 4 million tests per week to have Americans safely return to work. And we mentioned Dr. Giroir, who's heading up the testing initiative in the White House. He's far more cautious than Vice President Pence's pledge of 2 million a week. He says maybe half of that, which is, as you say, kind of where we are right now. But what is your sense of, you know, what happens going forward? May is around the corner.
So given that the U.S. conducted 1.6 million tests in the past week, scaling that up just to 2 million seems a pretty reasonable goal, especially with buy-in from these really major companies like CVS that do have immense capacity. Of course, from 2 to 3 and 3 to 4 million tests per week is an entirely different conversation. And I think there are public health officials who are very pessimistic that we will get to where we need to get to be able to allow states to reopen as aggressively as we've seen some states try to reopen their economies without there being new outbreaks of coronavirus cases that would result in, of course, the worst case scenario of having to return to this state of semi-lockdown until that next wave abates as well.
Well, and we should mention two other headlines today. New modeling shows that the rate of deaths does climb towards August, in large part because of people, you know, moving around more. And right now, there are 1,000 COVID-19 deaths every day. Lev Fascher, reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Thanks as always, Lev.
Thank you for having me.
8 of the 10 largest outbreaks in the country right now are in prisons, and that includes Marion County Correctional Center in Ohio, where some 2,000 inmates have tested positive. And now the virus has spread beyond the prison and into the community. Joining us now is Tracy Kinsler, Public Health Commissioner for Marion County. And Tracy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Tracy, let's start with the prison. Some 80% of inmates there are testing positive. Most are asymptomatic. What's the latest there?
We're up to well over 2,000. I want to say about 2,030 people or so that are inmates. And then we have about 121 community cases, and 70 of those are related to the MCI outbreak. They're the employees of the prison.
Mm-hmm. But to give context here, the numbers in your county are spiking because the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction decided to test nearly everyone in the prison, regardless of symptoms. Do you know why they decided to do that?
I think that they decided to do that because it gave them the best chance to separate and isolate people who are diagnosed with COVID from people who test negative.
Yeah. We're reading that the prison only has 9 infirmary beds. Do your local hospitals have enough capacity if the number of inmates gets seriously ill?
The Department of Rehabilitation and Correction contracts with Ohio State University, which is in Columbus. And so they have dedicated space there for the inmates. So far, they have had the capacity to do that at Ohio State. Certainly, yeah. If they don't and they need our local hospital, we're all willing to support and step in however we can here in Marion to do our part.
Yeah. Now there are more than 100 cases in the community, and half of those have been tied to the prison workers, as you mentioned. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that happened?
Even with their best efforts at the prison to clean, disinfect, have people wear masks and gloves, it's so contagious that we're going to continue to see this, I think. They have around 475 employees or so, and I want to say it's getting close to 200 that have tested positive. So I would expect that number to continue to rise. And then, of course, the majority of those people live in Marion County, so we see that as community cases here locally.
I know that there are several nursing homes in your area. You've expressed concern that a prison employee spouse could, for instance, work at one of these homes and then the disease could be spread that way. How do you stop something like that?
The Ohio Department of Health supplied local health departments with a stock of test kits. And so we made the decision that those kits needed to go to our nursing homes so they could immediately test anybody that they felt might be symptomatic so that we can catch it right away. And then they're being very vigilant with their employees. If they have been in contact with somebody who is a positive case, they're having them quarantine. And I would say that, you know, I feel like the people who have been positive from the MCI outbreak, for the most part, have been very cooperative and very willing to do their part. As we continue to grow in the outbreak, if nursing homes get to sort of that point where they're at critical staffing levels and they have to make those hard decisions about bringing people back to work, that's when we're going to start to see our level of concern go up even further, that they may be bringing people back too early, and then that will just contribute to another outbreak.
Yeah. What resources do you need from the state of Ohio and really the federal government to help keep this outbreak in your county contained?
One of our biggest problems still is personal protective equipment. We're hoping that now that's going to start to speed up and we'll be getting the PPE that we need. We just got a shipment from our stockpile on Friday, and it had a lot of masks in there. So we immediately started delivering those to nursing homes. They have been really struggling with PPE. even for the guards and the nursing staff at the prison and the inmates themselves, they all need that PPE. It's vital for them to have that so that they don't continue to spread it. I feel like that's the way that we're going to start to contain the virus.
And are there any PPE within the prisons now, or are you all just starting to deliver or request those specifically for the prisons?
They do have PPE in the prison. From my understanding, just like everybody else, they've been using it multiple times, reusing it, just like our hospital workers have had to do in the past. So I hope that they're getting what they need that way from the state. We're not in on a lot of those calls because it's a state agency. So they work directly with the Ohio Department of Health and the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. And then they reach out to us at the local level when they need that support.
That's Tracy Kinsler. She's the public health commissioner for Marion County. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Tracy.
Thank you for having me.
And we've been talking about how the coronavirus is ravaging the retail industry, with thousands of workers furloughed from chains like The Gap and Everlane. But it's not just the people who sell our clothes that are being hit. The people who make those clothes are also suffering. Mark Anner is director of the Center for Global Workers' Rights at Penn State University, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. And Mark, you've done quite a bit of research on the clothing industry in countries like Bangladesh, where trade groups are reporting that Western companies are actually canceling their contracts. Describe what you're hearing.
What I began hearing in mid to late March was abrupt cancellations of orders or orders being put on hold. So these are orders that are already in production or orders that are ready to be shipped. And these factory owners purchased the fabric, started working on it. The workers put in many hours. So they're waiting to get paid. And they were told by these brands and retailers that because of the crisis that they're facing in Europe and the U.S. and elsewhere, they would no longer make those payments. And that just rippled down the supply chain to, I'd estimate, about 40 million workers work in global supply chains making the garments we wear.
We understand, as a result of your research, some companies have now decided to reverse course and actually pay up. But who were some of the companies initially canceling these orders?
Well, the list was pretty long, a lot of recognized names. Primark, Walmart, Target, Gap, JCPenney, all the recognized names. In fact, this was the generalized response by brands and retailers.
Oh, wow. Who's decided to actually pay?
Well, the first one to recognize them is H&M. They were very quick. Once some of the news came out, PVH followed suit. And we now have a list of 12 corporations that are agreeing to pay in full for the orders that are completed or orders in production.
I want to talk a little bit about the workers who are mostly young women who you say earn about $100 a month. Describe how this kind of sudden halt in production is affecting them.
Well, it's just been absolutely devastating. I don't know other words to describe it. These are workers, like I said, $100 a month. So they live tiny paycheck to tiny paycheck. These are workers that don't have any savings to speak of. In fact, most of them are in debt. I'm now hearing reports from colleagues and experts in India and elsewhere. Some of these garment workers, after being laid off, are down to one meal a day. And they're talking about maybe 10 days more of food security. So it's really, really a very severe crisis for these workers and their families.
Mm. Zooming back out a little bit, this is also a big problem for Bangladesh as a country, which, as you note, depends almost entirely on the apparel industry, an incredible 84% of its exports. So how long can this country actually survive if it doesn't have this cash coming in?
That's a really important question, and I should emphasize there's at least short and medium term two questions that need to be answered. One is getting paid for production that was already finished, but going forward, when there are no new orders or very few new orders, this crisis could drag on for quite some time. The government is stepping up. The government is providing $588 million to go directly to workers, so that will help. But it would last maybe, depending on if it's full pay, it lasts about a month and a half. So I think really now to prevent a much more serious crisis, there is an enormous need for governments around the world and international financial institutions to step in and provide support to these governments.
Do you think we're going to see more onshoring of our clothing, clothes made here in the United States?
That's a possibility for some segments of the garment industry, but because of the pliant nature of cloth and the changing seasons and all these things, it's been very difficult to massively automate the industry. And so long as that's the case, I think countries like Bangladesh, India, Indonesia, Cambodia, and so on are going to continue to produce the majority of clothing that we wear. And the part that does come back due to automation is going to come back with much less jobs. So there's not going to be a boom in jobs in the U.S. It's going to be very high tech.
You've been covering this business for quite a long time. I mean, listening to you talk about these factories where our clothes come from, I'm thinking about these workers. They work 12-hour days or more, hugely indebted, really indentured workers in many instances. And yet there doesn't seem to be any great immediate alternative for them to switch to as far as work. I'm just wondering how you personally grapple with the effects of this. And in thinking about us buying our clothes and where we buy our clothes from and where these clothes are made.
Absolutely. I think about these questions a lot. This is a really big challenge, but I am convinced that we can, if we just slowed this all down, if they were down to 8-hour shifts and a normal pace of production, and if we didn't purchase so many garments every single year, we're up to about 85 garments for every American per year, we could make this industry work. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. The problem is that income doesn't trickle down the supply chain to the workers at the bottom.
Mark Anner is director of the Center for Global Workers' Rights at Penn State University, talking with us about how the coronavirus is affecting retail, but on the other side of the globe. Mark, thank you so much.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, Tyson Foods ran a full-page ad over the weekend in several newspapers warning that the food supply chain is breaking. Pork suppliers throughout the country are warning that we may see a shortage soon after outbreaks of the coronavirus and packing plants have forced many to shut down. At least 6 major pork processing plants have closed and many others have reduced operations. For more, let's bring in Steve Meyer. He's an economist at Kearns & Associates, specializing in pork production, and joins us from Oklahoma. Welcome, Steve. And as I mentioned, the board chairman of Tyson Foods, John Tyson, said, "The food supply chain is breaking." How accurate is that?
Absolutely accurate. This is a well-coordinated system in most cases. Farmers plan well in advance for the number of animals that are going to be needed by the supply chain and the amount of product that are going to be needed by consumers. And when we breed us out to have a litter, that's 10 months before those pigs will come to slaughter. We have a long string of pigs that are out there that are ready to come to market in any given time period. And so if they can't do that, it backs everything up. The beef industry isn't quite as well time dimensioned as that. They have a little more ability to keep animals in feedlots and then leave some younger animals on pasture. The broiler industry, they only have about an 8-week production cycle from the time they set an egg until the time they harvest a market-ready bird. And so the pork industry is the one that's really over the barrel the most here because we have a time dimension system that lasts for a long time period.
Yeah, we're talking millions of pounds of meat will disappear from the supply chain. That's a huge loss in production capacity. Are we already seeing pork shortages for consumers at this point, or will we soon?
Well, we're already seeing some situations where grocery stores don't have as much fresh pork as they'd like. And that started back in March, actually, when we first started closing down the food service sector in the United States due to coronavirus concerns. And consumers started buying more at the retail, and the retailers didn't have enough product to fulfill all that in the early stages. They've since restocked because we still had plenty of production coming until the packing plants started slowing down. And now, you know, we're going to have about 40% of the packing capacity idle today. It's not as if we're going to run out of pork. We're still going to have that other 60-some percent or whatever it is that we're producing. But in some places at some times, consumers may find that they can't buy fresh pork items.
And what about prices?
Prices of the wholesale product have been all over the board. They've been up and down.
But at the retail level, retailers tend to be the shock absorber in the system. They don't like to change their prices. And so I don't think there's going to be a lot of upward pressure on retail prices in the short run. But if this continues very long, then I think there will be some upward pressure on retail prices. But I don't think it's going to be just this week or next.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it's going to help pork producers find new processors or destroy pigs. Is that going to help make a difference for farmers?
Well, they're not going to find new processors. I mean, other than maybe move hogs to another plant. But the other plant has their suppliers that they have to take care of, too. And so, yeah. You know, last week we had about 500,000 pigs that should have gone to market that didn't. This week we're probably going to have another maybe as much as 800,000. Those hogs have to go somewhere at some point. Unfortunately, we're probably going to have to destroy animals that would be perfectly good sources of food for people just because we can't get them processed. You know, it's the same kind of thing you see with a produce producer plowing under lettuce or something, except it's a much more difficult task.
Absolutely. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around that sheer number that you just said of pigs that are now in this limbo. What does this do to hog farmers' livelihoods? Is this going to drive smaller farmers out of business or lead to consolidation?
Well, this is as damaging to large farms as it is to small farms. I mean, the fear we have is that at those kind of loss levels is that farms are going to not be able to continue financially. They're going to close. And a year or two down the line, we're going to have significantly less pork than we have right now and much higher prices. I don't think small producers are probably in any more peril than large ones in this case. The large ones are just losing money at a much faster clip.
That's Steve Meyer, economist at Kearns & Associates, specializing in pork production, and he joins us from Oklahoma. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oil futures plunged to $10 a barrel this morning, just days after they briefly turned negative last week. The recent collapse in oil prices is in part due to the fact that we're now driving and flying less. And in the last 30 days, 5 publicly traded oil companies have gone bankrupt. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad. He is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station FVPN. Hey, Robin.
How are you, Tanya?
Okay, I'm fine. Great. So we remember last week the plunge in oil futures was because we were running out of space to store the oil. Those prices recovered slightly. Tell us more about today's drop.
Yeah, not only do you have continued fear and loathing where storage is concerned, I mean, it's getting worse and the meter keeps running, but a giant ETF, the U.S. Oil Fund, is liquidating oil contracts. Hedge funds are circling, kind of licking their lips, and BP, a huge giant overseas, is out there declaring, quote, supply and demand shocks on a scale never seen before is what we are witnessing.
Okay, I want to ask you about something else. Russia and Saudi Arabia agreed to cut production starting next month, which would alleviate some of this downward pressure on prices. But do you think that's going to actually be enough?
It hasn't much put a dent in the oversupply, especially, you know, when you look at the deluge of production that's still out there at a time when so little is being demanded for transportation, for manufacturing, for heating. I mean, you only have some cities, some countries coming online fractionally. And then a lot of this production is still at 80%, at 90% where it was just a couple of months ago.
Okay. So we mentioned the bankruptcies just today. Diamond Offshore became the 5th publicly traded oil company to file for bankruptcy. But that company was also losing money 4 out of the last 5 years. So it's not like these problems are new, right?
Yeah, but I think what's different is that the easy money, the easy credit, much more of that risk appetite by energy sector investors and speculators, it allowed these weaker hands to stay in and keep producing as going concerns. What you're now seeing illustrates, I think if you put it in the words of the legendary Warren Buffett, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked. And that's been happening very rapidly in the oil patch.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of the other countries impacted. Iraq, for example, Venezuela, who just appointed an alleged drug trafficker to run its state-owned oil company. How vulnerable are those places, and how are they weathering this?
I'm surprised, frankly, that you've yet to see these streets erupt. I mean, after all, the plunging oil revenue for these economies mean a general inability to pay public officials, soldiers, key constituencies. You often have to cut essential subsidies elsewhere to make ends meet. I'm talking about Iran, Nigeria, Angola. So this has every oil-dependent economy terrified. And the longer this persists, the more you actually have a public safety street erupting risk.
And very quickly, in the time I have for you, what about renewables? Is there any silver lining on who stands to benefit?
Yeah, Tanya, there's traditionally been a parallel relationship between fossil fuel prices and the enthusiasm or investment in renewables. I can tell you that solar and wind, they've made enormous strides since the financial crisis. And coal, it's never been more in trouble. But those renewable players, they're now actively lobbying Washington for financial aid so they can continue the momentum through the pandemic.
Yeah. That's Robin Farzad. He is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. Robin, as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And we wanted to slow down for a second and ask, what do we know about COVID-19? What does it do to us? Out of 990,000 known cases in the U.S., about 118,000 are listed as recovered. But are they really? We know the virus attacks the lungs, but there's other long-term damage from being in medically induced comas on ventilators. Some people can't concentrate. There's heart damage beyond the usual strain on the heart from illness. Dr. Harlan Krumholz is a cardiologist and professor of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. And Dr. Krumholz, you've said this virus can attack almost anything in the body with devastating consequences. Its ferocity is breathtaking and humbling. What does that mean as a doctor to be humbled by a virus?
I think we're humbled in both directions. We're perplexed by the large number of people carrying it and spreading it without even knowing the harm that they're causing. And at the same time, we see that there's a minority of people who are affected in devastating ways. The virus can attack almost any organ system within the body. And as I've said, can do so with a ferocity that's rarely seen and can place people in positions where almost every body system is affected.
Oh, let's talk about that. We know it's respiratory. It causes pneumonia. Patients have said they feel a weight on their chest. They can't breathe. But why do they also feel terrible pain and fatigue? What's happening?
The body's reacting to the virus. There's a foreign invader. The body's defense system is preparing to do battle, and in doing so releases a lot of substances that both help us to fight the virus, but can also have what we call sort of systemic effects. They can make us feel lousy, and it's almost as if it's friendly fire from our own body. So it doesn't just exist in the lungs, but it exists in many places, including like the GI system and in the kidneys and in a lot of places. It's likely that we're going to continue to learn more about its direct harm. So people may have heard about this term cytokine storm. You know, these are these substances that are released as the body's fighting against the virus. It really is this sense that within the body, there is this sort of violent battle taking place.
Well, then, you know, answer perhaps one of the questions we had. There was speculation that younger, healthier people might be fighting it even more and have more of that cytokine storm that then takes over their body.
You know, that's another thing about this virus that continues to be perplexing. When you look back in history, for example, at the 1918-1919 flu, it seemed like the younger people were actually more susceptible to the virus. And there was a lot of hypotheses about just what you've said, that actually maybe a stronger immune system led to a stronger overcompensation. This, in contrast, seems to be most damaging to people who are older and people who've got other underlying conditions. Is it something about the immune system as it gets older? For this particular virus, it has trouble regulating. So it doesn't mean that young people are entirely protected. And we know that there are some tragic and unfortunate cases in younger people, but it's much less common.
And by the way, everything that we're talking about, we know we don't know enough yet, but we're looking for the latest thinking, and that brings us to the heart. Here's a sentence that caught our eye in Scientific American, which had a terrific piece on the heart in COVID-19. Patients with no pre-existing heart conditions who incurred heart damage during their COVID-19 infection, in other words, they were fine going in, have the infection, now they have heart damage, were more likely to die than patients with previous heart disease. Does that tell you that this virus isn't just taxing the heart, it's getting in the heart, it's attacking it?
Right, and I think it's important to unpack that. People published some articles, and many of them not yet peer-reviewed, but put them up online and were circulating that were important, that were telling us that if the blood test, which indicates damage to the heart, began to rise, that it was showing abnormalities, then that was a signal that that person had a much higher risk of having a difficult course in the hospital or even dying. Now, is that because of the damage to the heart? That would represent that the virus had somehow affected the heart, either the virus directly or through this reaction of the immune system. Or was it just simply a marker to say, once you see that, you know that the disease is widespread? The fact that it was reflecting damage to the heart was signaling that they were at higher risk and that we needed to pay attention more to those patients. But there's also a condition where the heart is markedly damaged, likely as a direct result of the virus. So many more people are showing mild damage to the heart than a smaller group is showing more damage to the heart. And that's the consequence that we fear. That's really major, in many cases, we think, damage that will persist after people get better.
Let's talk more about long-term effects. Damage to the lungs. Is there concern that ventilators, life-saving ventilators, may not be the answer for all patients? And then the second, you know, of course you think, well, if not a ventilator, what? But the high percentage of people on ventilators who have this long-term impact, why is that?
There are a lot of theories about what's going on with the respiratory distress, with the problems that people have with breathing, and what's the best response to them. There have been some people who have suggested that people have been put on ventilators earlier than maybe they should have and would have been benefited by trying to keep them off ventilators longer. There also have been maneuvers like putting people on their stomach and trying different things to prevent them from going on ventilators, in part because once on ventilators, it has often been difficult to get people off of ventilators and to help them recover. And some people have suggested that the ventilators may even be playing a role in that. But in the moment where people are having trouble breathing and they don't have good oxygenation, these are very difficult decisions. But people are trying to come up with different ideas. For example, one idea is that many of these people are suffering from the development of very small blood clots. And these blood clots in the very small blood vessels of the body are causing problems, including in the lungs. And at least in one place, they were even suggesting that if you gave people medication that broke up blood clots, that actually they might do better. Now, all of this needs to be tested. But what it shows you is that people are thinking deeply about lots of different mechanisms. We do not really deeply understand what we call the pathophysiology of this. What's really causing the underlying problems?
Right. You mentioned blood clots. People might know Broadway actor Nick Cordero. He starred in Rock of Ages. He recently had his leg amputated because he developed blood clots with a terrible bout with COVID-19. But again, some of the damage, kidney damage, so much so that some health experts are worrying about a shortage of dialysis machines. Why would the kidneys be so attacked?
Yeah, again, it's this idea that these entry points for the virus, the place where the virus docks in and then gets, you know, taken up by tissue, also exists within the kidneys. And there have been some biopsies that have shown evidence that the virus has directly gotten into the kidney. But then also there, again, is some concern that the immune system, in its effort to defend the body, ends up causing some damage. And then just by the course of being severely ill, there's lots of fluctuations in fluids and treatment with medications. So the combination, the direct action of the virus, the reaction of the body, the fluctuations in people's conditions and blood pressure and the medications we use, all these things can come together to affect the kidneys in ways that makes it more difficult for people to recover and can put them in a difficult position when they do. So that's why you're hearing a lot about the dialysis.
And for those people who come off ventilators and have lung damage, we're hearing it could take a year for them to recover. There's things like scarring, other diseases.
There's a lot we have to learn about the long-term recovery. Anything from, how about people who've had it without knowing it? Will anything crop up down the line that can cause problems, to people who've had it in a mild way, but also these people who have had it in a severe way and have survived a difficult hospital course? Many of them will have had damage. We don't know if that damage will get better. And then the long-term effects are something that also we're concerned about. So, for example, Often there are post-viral syndromes that are related to fatigue or pain or trouble concentrating that can last for long periods of time. We need to study that. And then there's an important piece of this that relates to just the trauma of it, you know, so that people have been through difficult ICUs, almost died without their families. People need to be able to be supported through this period because in a way it's like a post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, we want to say, hey, you're better, you're home. But sometimes that's only the beginning of an extended recovery period where people are getting their strength back, getting their bearings, and also their mental health is suffering in that period because they've just been through something so challenging and difficult. And so we need to, as a health profession, be very attuned, not just to managing and helping people in the most acute moments, the life-threatening moments, but we have to be there for them as they recover. And we have to, again, spread knowledge and learn how we can best support people throughout this. If we're lucky, it won't have a big effect downstream, but we have to be ready and poised to help people as they go through this if these things do crop up.
So perhaps a second wave of infections coming fall or winter, but also a wave of care for people who've already been through it is what it sounds like you and others are anticipating. Dr. Harlan Krumholz, cardiologist, professor of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine, answering some of our questions about the impact of COVID-19. Dr. Krumholz, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And the largest vaccine supplier worldwide announced this week that it will produce 40 million units of an experimental coronavirus vaccine, even though it's not clear if the vaccine will work. The Serum Institute of India plans to start production on the vaccine, developed by researchers at Oxford University in the UK and funded by the government there. The Oxford team had already been working on a vaccine against a different coronavirus when this pandemic hit, so they had a head start. Sarah Gilbert is a professor at the University of Oxford, and she told CBS News that she thinks there's an 80% chance of success.
I have a high degree of confidence about this vaccine because it's technology that I've used before. Of course, we have to test it.
The first humans were injected with the vaccine last week in a trial, and scientists at the National Institute of Health's Rocky Mountain Laboratory in Montana gave the vaccine to 6 monkeys and then exposed them to the coronavirus. A researcher told the New York Times about a month later that all of the monkeys who received the vaccine are healthy. Experts say that does not necessarily mean that the vaccine will protect humans, but if the human trials do prove effective, researchers say the vaccine could be ready as early as September, many months ahead of other potential vaccines. Well, we've been hearing on the show today that prisons have been hit hard by the coronavirus and are very vulnerable. So many of them have closed their doors to outside visitors to try and prevent the virus from being brought in and spreading out. Samantha Max of WPLN takes a look at the impact of this outbreak on a juvenile detention center in Nashville.
Laura Munoz's son just turned 18, but she didn't get to watch him blow out birthday candles or open any presents. Munoz's son is detained in the Davidson County Juvenile Detention Center in Nashville, along with 40 other teens.
This is his first birthday ever away from us, and he hates it.
As the coronavirus continues to spread outside its doors, the facility is taking extra precautions to keep its teens and staff healthy. That means Munoz's weekly visits with her son are on pause indefinitely. For now, she's making do with phone calls, but she says it's not the same.
Kids can tell you anything over the phone, but just to see his face and, you know, he's walking okay and he doesn't have any bruises or anything. Oh, he hadn't been into any confrontations and all, so it kind of took a toll on me.
When an employee tested positive in early April, the detention center moved to COVID-19 mode. Staff members get their temperature taken every day before they come in. One pod has been set aside as an isolation unit in case anyone starts displaying symptoms. And the center has bulked up on food, Gatorade, and personal protective equipment. Classes and group programs are also on hold for the time being. But Kathy Sinback, the juvenile court administrator, says the kids, who range from 12 to 18 years old, are coping well.
The parents have all been in contact with their youth and have expressed their concern and have told their kids, you better wash your hands, you better be sanitizing, you better stay distant. And what we're hearing from our contractor is that that's really working. The youth are listening to their parents.
The detention center is allowing the teens to make extra calls home throughout the week, including video calls. Simbeck says they've also stocked up on board games, video games, and playing cards. Youth in detention are already in a highly stressful situation, she says. The goal is to maintain as much normalcy as possible.
We, as juvenile court and the detention staff, are really their stand-in parents at this time. And so just as parents are trying to help their kids process the state of the world right now, it's even more important for detention personnel to do the same thing.
Still, criminal justice reformers want to see more. In March, advocates in 30 states wrote letters urging officials to release as many youth from detention as possible. Those advocates include Josh Spickler of Just City in Memphis, where at least one juvenile detention center employee has also tested positive. He says the loneliness teens experience while in detention has only been exacerbated by the coronavirus.
Without the contact with instructors and the contact with volunteers who often frequent these facilities, the sense of isolation has got to be crushing for some kids.
Studies show nearly all youth in detention have experienced at least one trauma, such as abuse or community violence. Spickler says keeping them away from loved ones can make matters worse.
What we know about kids is that at this point in their lives, isolation is one of the worst things that they can struggle with.
He says children should only be detained as a last resort. Nashville's juvenile court says it's sped up hearings so kids can go home sooner if they're eligible for release. And judges are choosing not to grant arrest orders when possible. The court says all of the teens still in detention face serious charges. Laura Munoz's son is supposed to find out soon if he'll be transferred to the adult system or if he'll get to come home. In the meantime, Munoz is telling him
that I love him, keep his head up, and that it's never too late to change and go down the right path.
And like most moms these days, Munoz is also reminding her son to wash his hands often. For Here and Now, I'm Samantha Max.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.